Chapter 7. So, what? You're gonna sit there in silence for the entire journey of 45 whole minutes? Steve twisted in his chair to look at Tony dead on. The jet flew itself, and Tony, in the span of 10 hours, had gone from a gaunt, unwashed mess to at least a gaunt, showered mess. What do you want me to say?
I don't know. Entertain me. Road trip games or something. I spy with my little eye.
Tony.
Jesus.
Tony sagged back in his chair.
Are you really that mad about the soldier?
What, no cutesy reference?
They're wasted on you.
Steve rolled his eyes.
I'm mad about the soldier. I'm mad about goddamn Hydra. I'm worried about what we're going to find.
Goddamn, huh?
Goddamn.
Steve said nothing, just clenched the strap of his clipped-in safety belt in his fist.
It's not like I'm... Look, I'm harboring your pet murderer, Steve. If that's not helping...
A rush of air left Steve's lungs, and he jerked his head to stare at Tony.
Pet murderer, Tony. Really? You saw...
Yeah, yeah.
Even if we didn't know about the implants and whatever it is in his brain...
I know. Tony stopped him. His voice was low, serious.
I know, okay? I know. I'm not the bad guy here, Cap. I'm not trying to be the bad guy. But I'm not going to let him...
He cut himself off, frustrated.
Look, I'm trying, with Bruce.
Steve's brow furrowed.
What does Bruce... He's not board certified, per se, Tony explained.
But he's got more doctorates than I do. And half of those are in biomedical engineering, biophysics.
So you're saying you want to put the Hulk in a room with the soldier, Steve said flatly. You don't think that might go badly? He's scared of me. He's scared of you.
No, I do think that it might go bad. Why do you think we agreed you were the only one who was allowed to get within spitting distance of him?
Tony fluttered a hand in Steve's direction.
Super soldier. And you beat him once already.
Twice.
Barely.
Don't admit to that. Come on. What's wrong with you?
But the only person more indestructible than you...
And Thor?
Is Bruce, Tony finished.
Unless you want Thor to provide medical care.
He snorted.
Though apparently he has a fake medical degree hanging around somewhere.
Steve inhaled deeply.
And Bruce isn't, board certified, but...
He has practical skills, Tony explained. Theoretical and practical.
We have to do this in increments, Cap. Build trust, as my overpaid therapist once said.
That's what we're doing.
No, you're trying to build his trust, Tony corrected sharply. I'm talking about mine. I'm responsible for lives here. I've got a nurse on my payroll with a cracked skull and a shattered radius. Or ulna.
Whichever... He held up his arm, rotated it slightly, jerked his chin towards his elbow.
This one is. Thing is, I'm on board. I'm on your side. You say jump, I say how high.
Pull the other one.
Yeah, that's not true. I didn't mean that. But point I'm trying to make here is that there's a plan. Bruce is... He's almost on board. He and Jarvis went over the scans with a few consulting physicians. Well, mostly Jarvis.
I thought you said Bruce had practical skills.
Tony's expression went tight.
Yeah, well.
What?
He looked at him, the films I mean, for about 2 seconds.
Tony lifted his shoulder in a half-hearted shrug and gave Steve a smile that was all teeth and utterly humorless.
Almost a full code green.
Steve closed his eyes.
The evidence of torture...
Jarvis had walked them through it, later, shown them the areas of accelerated bone growth, the odd precision of those healed-over breaks.
No, he'd seen them before.
Steve blinked. Before he could open his mouth, Tony bowled him over with a torrent of words.
Not all of them? Not the arm, not the implants. Nothing identifiable, like the replaced ribs. None of that. But photographs of cell regrowth over time, after... Injuries, films showing bone density, that kind of thing?
Yes, he'd seen it before. Old scans, data, research notes. All of it was part of a docket of research materials he got access to when he won the grant from the MRMC. The Army Medical Research and Materiel Command.
It took Steve a second before the pieces clicked. His chest went cold.
The serum. His research on the serum.
Bingo! Tony over-enunciated and drew out the word, then hesitated briefly.
They told him the materials were from the 40s. They told him it was you.
Jesus, Steve breathed, suddenly exhausted and not wanting to consider the fact that not only did this guy go back 50 years, not only 60 years, but maybe...
Jesus, he said again. So Bruce recognized them and...
Not full Kafka, just a little light puce, but he got it under control. Tony cleared his throat.
There's also the question of samples. He believes, he suspects anyway, that some of the tissue samples he based his research on
came from the soldier, Steve finished dully. It didn't take a genius.
So he's not thrilled about the other guy, of course, and that he might have been working for Hydra and didn't know it.
He and I have that in common, Steve retorted bitterly. To his credit, Tony said nothing. Steve pushed down the rage, the frustration, deep into his gut. It wasn't helpful. It wasn't.
So Bruce is our option for medical care, and he can't look at the soldier without...
He's doing his thing, Tony said with false levity. Adult coloring books, Enya, Himalayan healing crystals. And, like I said, he and Jay consulted. There's a plan for nutrition, there's a plan for the GPS trackers. That one's on me. And I've got a very well-paid neurosurgeon pinging me about better scans on the mask.
Steve felt the odd urge to lift his hand flat to his chest, please, and tamped it down.
Thank you, he said finally. You're doing the right thing.
Yeah, well, whatever, Tony prevaricated. I always say, when in doubt, do the opposite of Nazis.
A bubble of laughter in his chest caught Steve by surprise.
Yeah, he said. Yeah, I like that one.
With DC airspace shut down to all but government aircraft, the Quinjet landed itself on a private airfield about 20 miles south of their objective, the bank in Crystal City. Steve had his gear on already, and it was the work of a moment to flip the shield, dredged from the sticky riverbed of the Potomac a few days earlier, thanks to drones deployed by Stark Industries, onto his back. The saved time gave him the opportunity to watch as the elements of Tony's suit flowed and spiraled from their hidden compartments and cascaded into place around him. For all he had his differences with Tony, Steve was man enough to appreciate the skill, the artistic eye, that it took to create that miraculous clockwork, that harmonious precision. And it was just neat.
Let's hit it,
said Iron Man, and dropped out of the back of the jet. Steve followed. He had no sooner landed in a 3-point stance than Iron Man's faceplate had snapped up.
Intruder, he called out. I rented this airfield for private use only. Me. You're not me.
Natasha offered them her practiced Mona Lisa smile.
Hello, boys.
I'd have thought you'd have your hands full, Steve said as Natasha steered, shifted, and clutched the car into submission. What with the hearings and all.
Oh, that old thing? She shot him a little glance from the corner of her eye. Please.
Steve didn't question the rush of fondness that swept him. It would have startled him 10 days ago. Now, this friendship felt familiar, deeply rooted in the way he had forgotten how to miss.
You sure you don't?
Steve? Her voice was stern. We talked about this. You're the good guy who saved the day. I'm the spy who spilled the United States government's secrets out for the world to see. Leave me to my gray area.
What they're saying about you
is fine.
Isn't right, Steve said, frowning. It's not.
And when did that stop anybody?
He sighed and stared out at the passing streetlights.
Hill was surprised when you stayed here instead of...
Playing psychologist to the most notorious assassin who ever lived, Natasha finished pleasantly. Did it occur to you I might be jealous?
Steve rolled his eyes.
Nah, that my feelings might be hurt.
If you were an assassin, you'd be my favorite,
Steve interrupted loyally. The crack didn't have its desired effect. Her mischievous expression faded.
Well, that's the thing, Steve, she said. I was.
Nat.
You didn't ask me what I thought you should do with him. She was focused intently on the road, or appeared to be. If you had, I would have said.
She clicked her tongue.
What?
I think you know.
You don't think he deserves a chance?
It's not really about what he deserves, she returned calmly. It's about what the world deserves.
You mean it's pound of flesh? You know that he was...
I know what he is. And I don't mean justice, Steve. I don't mean revenge. The world's a better place without dangerous people in it. Without him in it.
People can change.
I thought so, she said, with a wry twist of her lips.
You did.
Did I? Steve sighed, thinking of, I guess I can't tell the difference anymore, and the reek of smoke on their clothes, the odd incongruity of scrambled eggs and bacon cooking downstairs, and the sudden realization of, here's the person inside Natasha. She was there all along.
I believe you did, he said firmly. And I believe he can.
Looks like nobody's home, said Iron Man once they arrived. Did a scan, looked at the who's it what's it's. Nothing in there. Could be a trap, but...
One shoulder of the bulky armor lifted in an awkward, mechanical shrug.
We can still go in, guns blazing. That's my vote. Guns set to blaze.
I don't have a gun, said Natasha. And since we're breaking into a privately held facility...
Jarvis is working on that. He's on layer... Jarvis, what layer are you on?
32, sir.
32,
Tony proclaimed.
Buying up shell companies with our own shell companies. It's a whole, you know... Shell game.
Good one, said Steve mildly. Regardless, Natasha continued as she led the way to the service entrance in the back of the building. EMP in 3, 2, 1. It wasn't the most viscerally exciting break-in which Steve had ever participated in his life. No, that honor still belonged to the Ritz in Paris, March of 44. This place couldn't be more different. It was empty, for one, just as the scans had showed. Steve was almost disappointed. The first floor looked like a bank. It had cubicles and corner offices, an unused, empty row of teller's desks, a protective cage around them. Counter-height stations for filling out deposit slips dominated the lobby, and Natasha wandered over to inspect a bulletin board. Well, I guess we know when this place was purchased. She leaned in to scan the faded flyers. Hey, Steve, want to go see a surf garage show at DC Space?
I want to search the rest of it.
Steve's tone was short. Now that they were here, he was antsy and revved for a fight. It had been hours since he'd left New York, and left the soldier with Sam, and seen the look of disbelieving jubilation in his eyes that he was going to be allowed to learn more signs. Elevator! Tony's voice carried. He wasn't in the suit. Steve and Natasha turned back and followed the sound through the teller space and back into the employee hallway. The Iron Man suit stood motionless, facing the service entrance. Tony himself had his hands in his pockets as he leaned against the elevator doors. My guess is Hydra Secretarial Pool upstairs, Evil Torture Dungeon downstairs. That's usually how it works, said Natasha lightly. The elevator dinged. Let's go. They were deposited into a well-lit hallway, and easily spotted the tarnished brass sign identifying one set of double doors. Vault. The doors were unlocked, and they walked right in. It didn't smell old. It wasn't dusty. It was cluttered, but not in the way that old places collect boxes and old furniture. It was a small, functional space, burdened with banks of computers and file cabinets, oddly claustrophobic with the rows and rows of safety deposit boxes on the walls. And...
Steve? Natasha's voice was low and emotionless, artificially steady, familiar from when she was at her most performative, and their circumstances the most dangerous.
Well, that's ominous, said Tony, walking towards it. Steve couldn't help but follow. It was a chair of some kind, hooked up to a series of monitors and gadgets,
with a swinging arm and a nest of cables.
Steve, said Natasha again, and he looked back at her. She stood in the doorway, her gaze fixed on the mess of technology that had captivated both his and Tony's attention. Her fists were clenched.
Don't go near it.
Something dark and acrid curled in Steve's gut, a frisson of dread that danced its way up his spine and throat.
What?
I'm afraid of it, she said, pronouncing her words carefully, deliberately. Her face remained as impassive as ever. She hadn't taken one more step into the room.
You're afraid of it?
Tony leaned his weight on the worn leather seat of the thing, peering into its coils and cables.
Of this?
Why? Steve asked her finally.
Why are you afraid of it? What does it do?
She made eye contact with him then. For the first time he could recall, she looked young. I can't remember. Chapter 8. For a beat too long, Steve stared at Natasha. And then, nearly unconsciously, he swiveled his head to look back at the chair. It certainly didn't look like anything he'd ever seen before. Not that his span of experience was especially robust. For all he knew, it could have been some sort of high-tech dentist chair, or a kind of scanning device, or even a bizarre bench press. But not for nothing did Natasha's carefully controlled admission echo in his mind. The words rolled over themselves, again and again, and he prodded at them like he might a canker sore in his mouth, back when he still got those. I can't remember, she'd said. His eyes catalogued the solid open claws of what could be restraints, waiting for the thing, the person, they were meant to restrain. He saw the uncomfortably narrow seat, the obvious hydraulics and hinges that hinted at the chair's ability to move its user where it liked. And he saw the foreboding semicircle that would hang over the head of someone strapped into it. Tony had stepped away from the thing, too, the moment Natasha had warned them off it. He stood with one hand twitching in his pants pocket, and the other fidgeting in plain view. Abruptly, he kicked at the bottom of it.
"It's bolted down," he said.
"Here. If I had to do, back-of-the-napkin calculations?" He peered down to look at the base more closely. It was as hardy as the outriggers on a fire engine. "It's about, say, 6 square feet surface area. Based on the look of this hardware, it's probably 10,000 PSI. He looked back up at Steve. "Pounds per square inch, to move it. How much do you deadlift, Cap?" Steve didn't reply. For one, he didn't know. Two, he was focused on Natasha.
"It's nothing good, is it, Nat?"
She shook her head, just once, slow and smooth.
"No."
And she inhaled, just a touch too deeply for it to be natural. Her locked-down expression flickered briefly, and she precisely, deliberately, stepped inside the vault. She could handle herself, and Steve doubted she would appreciate him monitoring her. He turned his attention to the rest of the room, while Tony carefully telegraphed his movements as he stepped back to the chair. Steve forced his tactical brain to digest the rest of the room. The contents of all the security deposit boxes would need to be examined. Natasha was stepping over to the computers, better her than him. A sheaf of printouts on the floor behind the monitors on wheeled bases looked like they might have medical information. They'd need to scan them. On the long desk beside the computers, a series of binders, and hanging on a cheap plastic hook, the kind with adhesive on its back. He stepped over to it and reached down to the side of the desk, plucking the D-ring from the hook, along with the laminated sheets it bound together. WS-001, Block 03, B. Handling signals, FY 2006 through present. Table of contents. 1. List of figures. Page II. 2. Instructions for use. Page 1. 3. Statements. Page 4. 4. Interrogatives. Page 9. 5. Objects. Page 11. 6. Miscellaneous. Page 19. 7. Reportable incidents. Page 21. 8. Index. A-1. Revised. 29 May, 2011. Steve's chest went tight with horrible suspicion. He flipped to the next page, and the next, knowing exactly what he was searching for. He stopped. A ragged curl of laminating plastic had begun to peel away from the paper on the bottom right-hand corner. But there it was. Simple, bold line work, though the drawing had gone a little fuzzy from repeated Xeroxing. The index and middle fingers, both curled, the ring and pinky fingers tucked into the palm, the thumb straight out, accompanied by careful arrows indicating motion and the instructions. Shake hand twice in lateral motion to complete the signal. Sorry. Steve felt sick. He remembered every detail of that first initial conversation with the soldier. He'd told him, "You tried to kill me twice." Sorry, the soldier had apparently said. Sorry. They kept him here, he said finally, looking up at his two companions. He held up the... what, the operating instructions? This pathetic vocabulary that comprised the soldier's entire ability to communicate? For them to see. This confirms it. Custom hand signs, said Natasha, glancing up from her screen while her fingers kept flying over the keyboard. That's what we thought. Yeah, I guess it's what we thought. He set down the manual. Handling signals. For Christ's sake. What have you found? Not much. Her voice was cool. This encryption's from the 70s. Looks like a Michelese algorithm. My usual tricks aren't quite good enough. Stark, a little extra juice from Jarvis would be appreciated.
I thought the older it is, the easier it is, Steve offered stupidly. Code breaking, I mean.
Nah, said Tony, without looking up from where he was poking into the mechanical guts of the chair.
Not always. Screwed around at an MIT hackathon a few years ago, tossed a Hydra Enigma at him, you know, 7 or 8 rotors instead of the usual 3 or 4. Just the software, not in...
He grunted a little as he maneuvered something inside the frame.
Actual Enigma. Took him 4 days to get a single word. And that's from ye olden days, Cap, back when you were in your prime. Michelese, huh?
Steve exhaled heavily through his nose and clenched his jaw. Hackathon? Enigma? Rotors? What?
That mean you can't break it either?
Tony's must head popped up from behind the chair.
Of course I can do it, he said indignantly. Just gotta take those, he gestured at the computers. With us.
Natasha leaned back from the workstation. Well, there's still the surveillance footage, she said. It's on a separate system. Easy.
Yeah, I want to see that, said Tony. Maybe there's some footage of this thing in action. See if it matches up with the demand spikes. Got a feeling it does, based on the size of these cables. 10 kV, at least.
He stood up and wiped his hands on his t-shirt.
Punch it, Nat.
It did match up. Natasha had navigated in the security system to the morning of the attempts on Fury's life, the first time Steve had encountered the soldier, when he'd shot Fury through the wall. There were 3 cameras covering a span of about 80% of the vault. The cramped room had been bustling with lab coats and sport jackets, with a couple of familiar faces wearing tactical gear and bearing standard-issue M4s, all 10 of them leaning up against the safety deposit boxes and looking bored. One had a bad habit of biting his nails, which they watched in 8x speed for a few minutes until the tenor of the room changed completely. This is 12 hours from the first attempt on Fury, said Natasha professionally, adjusting the settings so that the video played at normal speed. And shortly before one of the demand spikes. The building's energy data is captured in 15-minute intervals, so we'll start here and see what happens. The tension in the room was easy to perceive, even lacking audio and accounting for the detachment that came from watching security footage. The lab coats pressed themselves against the walls and clustered together in groups, The nail-biter and his buddies all stood up straight, their index fingers displaying perfect trigger discipline. The hustle of busy people slowed to a crawl, every single one of them with their eyes trained on the east-facing wall, where there was a steel door Steve, Tony, and Natasha hadn't investigated. The soldier appeared on the screen, suspended between two additional guards, a third following behind, with a gun trained on the back of his head. He was half-naked, his hair so wet it adhered in clumps to his face, to the mask, and they half-carried him into view, staggering as they labored to manipulate his dead weight. When his head rolled back so his face was visible on camera, as ever, the mask hid everything but his eyes. "Drugged," Natasha commented. But while the soldier didn't seem exactly loosened, he wasn't calm either. His eyes were wide with panic, the whites bright and round. The claw-like fingers of his flesh hand convulsed and clenched around empty air. When he tried to get his weight under him, tried to stand, or, Steve realized, dig his heels in, his legs trembled and collapsed under him. They manhandled his weak, unresponsive limbs into the chair. He surged forward, attempting to get away, but the restraints snagged him, locked him into place. Steve reached forward, across Natasha, and pressed pause. "Nat." She was stock still, staring transfixed at the playback just like he and Tony were. "Steve," she retorted, and snaked her hand past his to press play. They watched as the soldier struggled impotently against the shackles, and how his spectators rustled and recoiled at every shake and shudder of the machine as their captive gave his all to escape it. "They're afraid." Tony's voice was as serious as Steve had ever heard it. "Jesus, he's like that, and they're still scared of him." The men with guns, the techs, the goddamn computer geeks, they were all focused on the soldier, and all as physically far from him as it was possible to be. The chair in the video tilted back, heedless of its struggling victim. Not 20 feet away from them, the same chair waited, motionless and silent. "Oh no," Tony murmured. "Oh shit." 10 kilovolts, Tony had said. The halo rotated and spun, a curved panel settled into place around his scalp and face, and abruptly, the soldier's body went rigid. Electrical light flicked from under the contraption pressed to his head. The tendons and veins and muscles of his throat bulged.
What is it doing?"
Steve bit out. His stomach roiled. There was no sound, and there would be no sound coming from the soldier anyway. But not for lack of trying.
"Torture," said Tony flatly.
He was leaned forward, both hands pressed against the desktop, fingers digging ineffectually against the artificial wood surface.
"That's torture."
Natasha clicked something on the screen, speeding it up to 2 times. Several long moments later, the soldier's body finally went limp. The machine retracted from his skull, and the restraints opened. He sagged, his muscles unnaturally slack except for a persistent twitch and flutter in his right thigh and his biological arm. His chest shuddered and heaved. With the procedure complete, the room erupted into activity. The weedy scientists and doctors, if they could even be called that, approached the soldier confidently. One reached down and inserted an IV into his still spasming right arm. Another one placed electrodes on his chest. The soldier's head lolled, his eyes dull and drooping. Tendrils of sweaty hair clung to his forehead. Nausea surged in Steve's gut.
"They're not scared anymore,"
he said finally, through the sour rush of saliva in his mouth.
"I want to know what's in there," Tony said, nodding towards the steel door. His expression was hard. "Let's see where he came from."
It had clearly once been a men's bathroom. The 4 stalls had been removed, along with their toilets, but the plumbing openings still remained, along with 2 urinals. The tile was disrupted in the center of the room, where it looked like the floor had been torn up and a new drain installed. A large, stainless steel table stood over the drain. Ceiling-mounted surgical lights had been installed above it, and along one wall lived a bank of small metal carts, which were stacked with blank monitors, medical supplies, and other equipment Steve didn't recognize. In the opposing corner, there was an oddly incongruous tool chest. In the other, a strange tube, taller than Steve, locked into a heavily built stand against the wall. There was, he realized, a handle on the outside of it.
"Tell me that's not what I think it is," Tony breathed,
stepping over to it and trailing his fingers along the thick rope of cords and cables that extended from behind it to a complicated-looking panel and box installed in the wall.
"What do you think it is?"
Steve asked dutifully, stepping inside the room to examine its contents more closely. It was claustrophobic, the ceiling too low, the lights too bright. He blinked and let his eyes drag over the room. He spotted a pile of crumpled clothing by one of the surgical carts. He went over and crouched down beside the little heap. Tactical pants, he realized, a perfect match for the ones the soldier had been wearing before they'd exchanged them for scrubs. On his next inhalation, he winced. Urine. He stood back up, feeling unsettled, and leaned back against the table, waiting for Tony. He didn't wait long.
"This," Tony announced a moment later, standing up,
"is a cryostasis tube." He reached a hand up to the back of his neck, his expression pinched. "They froze him." Time stuttered. Rushing water, freezing cold, shards of ice in his chest, the cells of him bursting. Steve forced himself to swallow and blankly cast about for something to say.
"But it looks like an operating room,"
he managed, numbly.
"Look again," said Tony grimly. "Did ORs come with manacles in your day, Cap?"
Steve jerked his hands away from the table and stared down at where they had been. Open semicircles, a perfect match for the chair. Waiting, as the chair had been, for a victim.
"Fellas," Natasha called. "Got something."
Natasha rewound the tape again.
"Is there anything we can do to get sound?"
Steve asked again, frustrated.
"Or can Jarvis lip read or something?"
"I don't know if you noticed, Steve, but he's wearing a mask," Natasha offered lightly.
"Nat," Steve gritted his teeth. "This is... we need to know what they're saying."
"Give me the thing," Tony demanded, "with the signs."
On the screen, Alexander Pierce was frozen, paused, in the process of grabbing a handful of the soldier's hair and yanking his head nearly to a 90-degree angle.
"Jarvis will translate what Jason's saying, at least."
Steve snagged the laminated guide from the end of the table and slid it over to Tony, who reached into his pocket and unfolded an impossibly delicate little device that was no doubt packed with electronics. He perched it, a headset of some kind, Steve realized, onto his face, one half of the world's most advanced pair of eyeglasses. Quickly, methodically, Tony flipped through each page of the booklet.
"Got it, Jay?"
Jarvis's quiet, tinny voice emanated from the headset.
"I do, sir."
"Let's bump that up," said Tony matter-of-factly. "Piggyback on this workstation for me."
"Here, sir."
Now coming from the computer's speakers.
"Ready when you are."
"Let's do it."
Nat rewound again. Inert, the soldier sat on the chair. He was shirtless, again, and seemed to take no notice of the technician operating hand tools deep inside his arm. Tubing from an IV pole wound its way to his flesh arm. Moments before, he'd had those fingers around another technician's throat. Alexander Pierce swept into the frame, his back to the camera. Seconds later, he reached forward, threaded his fingers in the soldier's hair, and jerked.
"Sorry, sorry, sorry,"
said Jarvis in a monotone, in time with the frantic movements of the soldier's hand.
"Sorry, sorry, sorry."
A short pause.
"Why target?"
said Jarvis.
"Why target?"
Another pause.
"Please target,"
said Jarvis. The soldier's fingers fluttered and twisted.
"Please, why target mission?"
Something cold and slick filled Steve's throat, his lungs, an awful imprecise foreboding creeping through his veins as he watched the soldier's straining eyes, the pleading there, the confusion.
"Please, why mission?"
said Jarvis colorlessly.
Please, why, mission?
Pierce turned to a technician at his elbow. His lips moved. That Steve could pick up. Wipe him.
Sorry, sorry, sorry,
said Jarvis.
Please, sorry, sorry.
Two technicians pushed him backwards in the chair. Dazed, he didn't fight back. The restraints locked him in place. His chest surged, like bellows, and... Tony's hand darted forward, stopped the playback. We're done, he said. He was pale, his dark hair and goatee contrasting dramatically against clammy skin. We're done. We're not... I'm not watching that again. He turned his body to Steve, away from the screen completely. We're getting him help. Let's get him some help. Chapter 9. Eyes hurt, head hurts, skin wet, sweaty. Don't move. Nothing changed in the cell when... Open eyes. Small box made of cardboard. With clothes and a blanket, a book, and socks, and a shiny white board. All in the corner so he could see it. Blanket with a zipper, a bedroll, a sleeping bag is what Sam calls it. Still in the same place. Warm. On top of it. And a pillow. Under the shoulder. A pillow. Word page is still there, in the corner. Next to the sleeping bag. And the empty water bottles. There are four now. The word pages are where they were when... Don't move. Keep still. Blink. Swallow. Grittiness like sand in the eyes. Sleep. He'd slept. Of course he'd fucking slept. That's what this is. Jesus, get it together. Focus. Feet in socks. That's the same. Ankles hurt. Knees hurt. Pulse. Throb. With blood. It all hurts. Ribs, wrist, elbows, shoulders. Shoulder. Head. Wipe him. Left hand flat. Right hand chop. Stop. Knock it off. Still hurts. Before. Right hand, toss it over your shoulder. Yeah, kinda like you're high-fiving somebody backwards, I guess. Or throwing a ball behind you. There was more water, and a blue drink, Gatorade, and more words. And Sam read a book.
Buck, can you please, please, please read the one with...
With... D'Artagnan. After.
To be honest, man, I'm not sure what the difference between those two signs are, so we're gonna go with this. Let's do this one. You put your hands flat in front of you, stack them in front of each other like this, right? And pull your right hand forward.
It was.
Try to get some sleep, okay?
Try to get some sleep. Sure, where is it then? And then Sam stood up, said... Roll this out, get comfortable, and turned around, but, come on, where's Steve? Don't leave, not yet. Hit the floor, with the fist, very loud. Gotta do it. Not supposed to, what did he do? Focus. But Sam turned around, smiled. What's up, man? Steve Rogers, where did he go, and when is he coming back? Is he coming back? Come on, Steve, please. Right fist went up. Not the left one, so Sam wouldn't think he didn't want to. Further aggression will not be tolerated, soldier. Right fist up. The left, flat. Pull around in a circle. In front of the fist. Push it all forward. A block. It's the shield. Come on. Eyebrows went up. Mouth dropped open. Surprise. Holy shit, you're asking about Steve?
Yes. He made up his own word. His own. Nod for yes. Index finger up. Shake it around. Where? Fist and shield. Steve. Left index finger. Hold in place. Right index finger. Loop around. When? Fist and shield. Steve. Please. Sam smiled.
Well done. Wow. Just, that's great. Steve's in D.C., man. Doing some work, looking into some things to help you. He'll be back tomorrow. Okay?
That was before, tossing a baseball over your shoulder.
Come on, Buck, how about that slider, huh?
He'd slept. That was before. This was today. Everything where it was before. Nothing moved, not even him. Sleep warm, not cold. Empty water bottles. Keep still. Blink. The eyes hurt. It all does. He'll be back tomorrow. When is that? And in a circle for, I don't know. Swallow. Throat dry. Head hurts. Hurts bad. Focus. Just don't move. Breathe. Be still. The mask hurts the whole head where it is pressed to the ground. Be still. Be still except the hand. Tap, tap, tap. Drag, drag. Tap, tap. Drag, drag, drag. Movement. The door. Rush of air. Footsteps. Look at the empty water bottles. Look there, not anywhere else. Don't move. Don't move.
Jesus fucking Christ, he pissed himself again.
Hey, pal, says Steve Rogers. You up? Steve. Steve, it's me. Steve Rogers is here. Not up, but he can get up. Sit up. Sit up. Oh, shit. Oh, fuck. The head. The blood. Blink. Blink.
Some sleep?
No, no, no. Don't miss it. Don't miss anything. What did he say? Blink. Blink. The eyeballs hurt. Get up. Focus. Tap, tap, tap. Drag, drag.
Hey, hey. Easy, says Steve. I didn't mean to startle you.
Yeah, what the fuck, Rogers?
Focus.
Steve has one hand up, palm out. The other has a paper. It has papers.
Good morning.
He touches his hand to his mouth, pulls his arm down and out.
Good morning, he says again. That's the sign for that.
Take a goddamn nap, why don't you? Even you gotta sleep, pal.
Can I sit down?
Question. Question for him. Yes. Nod. It hurts, but nod. Steve Rogers sits. His legs are Taylor style. Cross the legs also. It hurts to move them, but do it anyway. Taylor style, like Steve, so he...
What, you don't want to play for keeps, Buck?
Feeling. Fuck, oh no, what did he say? Focus and look, even though moving the eyes is like... It's like...
Fist circled on the chest. Sorry, sorry, sorry.
Sam taught, again. Say, again. One hand flat. Other hand swoops in, touches the middle. Again. Sorry.
Steve's eyes are big. Upset. He is upset. Nostrils go wide. Don't move. Don't move.
You don't need to. It's fine. No apology needed. Just asking how you're feeling.
Status report. So many words now. Wiggle fists. Cold. Index finger. From chin to chest. Thirsty.
Say it.
Status report. Report. Index fingers up. Point at each other. Twist. Hurts. Do it again. Hurts. Please.
Hurts, said Sam in his ear.
You got that, Cap?
Steve knew. Sam had spent 20 minutes quizzing him on all the soldiers' new signs before even considering letting him inside the cell.
We gotta put the same amount of effort in that he is, Cap. Run him again.
Hurts, he'd said. Well, the soldier certainly looked like he was in pain.
They'd known he was awake thanks to Jarvis monitoring his vitals, but he'd rigidly held himself in his cramped, curled-up position on top of Sam's childhood bedroll with its faded cartoon turtles until the moment Steve had entered the room. And even then, it had taken several long, uncomfortable seconds for him to laboriously unfold himself from his childlike pose and rearrange his limbs to match Steve's seated position. His forehead was damp with sweat, his visible skin pale. He reeked with an unhealthy, chemical-tasting stench. And all in all, he moved in the sort of way Steve had, once upon a time, when stricken by the flu or a flare-up of arthritis. Like it hurt to move. Like it hurt to breathe. "Hurts," he'd said, after a long, hesitating pause, where he'd repeated thirsty and his mismatched hands had hung in the air, suspended, before finally they fluttered into the smallest twist, his index fingers barely straightened. "I'm sorry about that," said Steve once the soldier's hands had dropped limply back to his lap. "Is it something specific that we can help with? An injury, or..." "I don't know," said the soldier. "Sorry, I don't know." His eyes slid away from Steve as he answered. The metal hand dug into his thigh. "Hang on, let me..." Steve started, reaching for the folder he'd brought into the room with him and retrieving his pencil from his breast pocket. He flipped the folder over and quickly sketched out a cartoon version of the man across from him, with crossed legs, socked feet, a dashed-off metal arm, long hair hanging over a messy oval of a face, and... Steve hesitated. Frankly, it seemed so cruel to draw the mask. Instead, he added a little squiggle for a nose and an angled slash for a mouth, finished it off with a bit of rough shading, and then flipped the folder around so the soldier could see it. The soldier stared at it, actually leaned forward, toward Steve, his entire attention locked onto the little drawing. He was entranced.
"It's you,"
Steve said unnecessarily, and then watched as the soldier's flesh hand almost instinctively lifted from his lap and pressed to his own chest, as if to say, "Hey, that's me." Steve swallowed.
"Can you show me, on the drawing, where you're in pain?"
The soldier glanced up at him and deliberately flicked his eyes to the pencil. Steve grinned.
"Good point. Here."
He held it out, eraser first. Several beats passed.
"You can take it," Steve said. "It's okay."
Finally, the biological hand tentatively reached forward. The acrid stink that clung to his skin grew stronger as his hand approached Steve, who carefully schooled his face into neutrality. It certainly wasn't the soldier's fault. Almost delicately, the soldier plucked the pencil from Steve's grasp. He flipped it around, as deftly as he'd handled a knife, and the pencil settled comfortably between his thumb and his index and middle fingers. Steve stared. Not even 2 days ago, he'd held the marker like he'd never seen one before, like it was a weapon, but the pencil... The soldier pulled the drawing closer to himself and pressed the tip of the pencil to the surface. Slowly, he dragged a single, unbroken line around the little figure of himself, a confident loop, then set the pencil down and withdrew his hands. Steve leaned forward, his stomach going tight with sympathy and dismay. "Everything?" he asked after a moment of staring at the circle in which the soldier had imprisoned the cartoon version of himself. "Yes," the soldier nodded. "I'm sorry," said Steve gently. "I know that some of it's our fault, keeping you here, and that we don't know how to..." He struggled for the words. "Handle him? Manage him? Operate him in the way the binders of material at the bank had instructed?" The thought tasted bitter. "But we're trying to help. Sam told me. You asked where I was yesterday?" Steve performed the little sign that Sam had demonstrated for him, the fist and the circular sweep of the extended palm over the fist that the soldier used for Steve. Sam had been giddy about it.
"He's in there, man. He's smart. If we just give him a chance..."
The soldier tensed, staring at the Steve sign, and then nodded again, very slowly. "Yes." He held himself stiffly, his bloodshot eyes fixed in Steve's direction, but not on his face.
"We found where Hydra was holding you," said Steve. "No mincing words, no euphemisms, just let's be straightforward with him," Sam had said. The soldier didn't react, though if it were even possible for his muscles to go tenser, Steve doubted he'd be able to tell. He cleared his throat.
"We were looking for information. You're learning sign really fast. That's good."
The soldier's eyes flicked up at him.
"But to help you, to make you feel better, to know how to help, we needed more information. Does that make sense?"
"I don't know."
"All right," said Steve. "Well, I'd like to. I've got some photographs here. I want to show them to you and ask you some questions. If you don't want to answer, you don't have to. If you want to do this later, we can wait. But you're not looking too good, pal, and we want to help now."
At first, it seemed as though the soldier hadn't heard. Steve waited. And then the soldier reached forward, picked up the pencil again, and leaned forward. The little cartoon mouth, the angled slash. The soldier pressed the tip of the pencil to the end of the mouth, pulled it carefully upwards, a small, deliberate curl. The soldier leaned back and pushed the drawing towards Steve. He'd given himself a smile. Steve couldn't help but grin back. Either it was a joke, his second joke, or he was trying to show that he was really smiling. Steve peered at the soldier's face, tried to find evidence for one at the corners of his glassy eyes, but there was nothing.
"Nice," he said finally. "I like it."
He flipped the folder around, lifted the front cover up. A photograph of the exterior of the bank. He handed it over to the soldier.
"This is where we went. Does it look familiar?"
The soldier carefully set down the image. "I don't know." He hesitated, then raised a trembling hand to his face, covered his own eyes, while the metal hand was locked in a fist.
"They blindfolded you?"
Both hands dropped, the metal one to his right foot, crossed under his left leg, hidden by his thigh. Steve could hear it straining, whirring, the mechanics of it loud in the silent space, evidence of the soldier's anxiety. "Yes," he said.
"Okay," said Steve, swallowing. "How about this?"
The cramped, dank little men's bathroom, with its bolted-down tables, the rows of metal carts, the medieval-looking cryo-tube.
"It's got signs of struggle," Tony had said during their second walkthrough before packing up the computer hard drives and heading back up to the jet.
"Inside, Cap. Signs of struggle inside of it."
It had been a miserable little room in person, and in the photograph it seemed somehow even more bleak, with its severe lighting and green-tinged tile and years of accumulated dirt. The soldier didn't take the photo. He just stared at it, his eyes unfocused, and finally Steve set it down in between them.
"Do you recognize this?"
The soldier's metal hand was twitching as it gripped his socked foot. The other hand lifted in a fist, a wiggle. Cold. He didn't look at Steve. Cold.
"Yeah, okay. That's what we thought," Steve said, feeling ill. "Last one."
He took the cryotube photo back, set it to his left.
"Last one," he said again,
even as his own gaze hitched and stopped at the side of the chair. In person, it had been ominous, unnatural. In a picture, it seemed like something out of a nightmare.
"Here you go," Steve said, flipping up the photo.
Steve could hear the soldier's sudden, sharp intake of breath, could see the way his body stuttered, an aborted flinch, animal panic compressed into muscles.
"I'm sorry," he said, the words feeling grossly inadequate. "I'm sorry. I know you must be scared of it."
The soldier wasn't listening. He'd lifted his biological hand to his chest.
"Sorry, sorry, sorry," he was saying, shaking his head. "No, no, no, sorry, sorry, sorry."
Steve didn't think. He leaned forward, extended his arms, folded his hand over the one pressed to the soldier's chest, rested the other on his shoulder.
"It's okay," he said. "It's okay.
The soldier sagged into his touch, the weight of him, less than when they'd fought, pouring forward into Steve's hands. He was warm, too warm, and he smelled. But he was flesh and blood just like anybody else, just like Steve. And where Steve's hands met the soldier's skin, there was a racing pulse, either the soldier's or his own. And he could feel the soldier's quivering, shuddering muscles. When was the last time he'd been touched out of comfort, out of compassion?
"I got you," Steve repeated again and again, trying to keep his voice calm, his tone kind even as rage churned in his gut. "I got you. It's okay, pal. It's okay."
Slowly, the soldier's breathing evened out, and he dragged his shaking hand away from Steve's, up to his forehead, pulling it away, the pinky and thumb stretched out. His eyes gleamed dully. "Why?" he wanted to know. "Why?" Steve swallowed, one hand still on the soldier's shoulder.
"What does it do?"
The soldier's eyes squeezed tightly shut. His chest heaved in three short breaths, and he opened them again, focused. He reached forward for the folder with his flesh hand and doggedly clawed at the pencil with the metal one. He'd dropped it on the floor at some point, and it was too small even for the remarkable dexterity of the prosthetic. The metal hand snapped it in half, trying to pick it up. The soldier finally captured just the end with the eraser. He flipped the folder over. The cartoon with its smile stared up at them. He leaned forward, his breath loud and rancid-smelling in the small circle of space they shared, and attacked it. Steve watched, realization dawning thick and slow and sick, as the little cartoon disappeared from the page in violent, rough drags of the eraser, the metal arm digging so deeply that it carved trenches into the cardstock. The soldier stopped. The broken pencil dropped back to the ground. He pushed the ruined drawing back to Steve and curled back up on himself, his body trembling, his eyes flat. "It erases," he was saying. "It erases."